San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB, presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future. Now, It's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
Good evening. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, producer for It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with 50,000 watts of power, KFMB, here coming to you live from Kearny Mesa. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, Los Angeles County, up to Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now it's my pleasure and honor to introduce the main man of the hour, the distinguished CPA, long-distance runner, marathoner, family office guy, and all-around good guy, friend to many, Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I am doing great. Happy New Year, halfway through the year. It's July 1st.
That's
a happy half New Year.
It most certainly is. It most certainly is. And we've got a great show lined up tonight. We're finally going to get into some intense financial matters this evening. But before we get into the show, Richard, I think we ought to alert everybody to what we're doing next week, which is that terrific event. We'll be our second live remote will be at the legendary landmark La Valencia Hotel. Did you know that, Richard?
I have it on my calendar. It's in ink, Joe, and it's because of, we have to hope that we don't have extra innings down at Petco.
That's right, because our guest is the legendary sports broadcaster who's done about every major sporting event on the planet, Dick Enberg, and La Jolla resident, and we'll be pleased to have him on. I'm sure that's going to be a great, great show. And there's a connection to this show tonight due to that event, because our guest is one of our prime sponsors, UBS, one of their analysts. But in studio with us is Vice President Michael Quaranta, whose office is right down the street from the La Valencia. So we'll get a lot of UBS people there, I hope. Right, Michael?
I think you will. Hopefully some extra visitors associated with us.
Right.
And in fact, people can come out early because we'll be getting set up early. If people want to come out around 5:30-ish.
Should we tell them about the special event preceding our show?
Go ahead, Joe.
All right. Well,
since you've been working on it forever.
I've been working on this project since probably 1998. But the best kept secret in San Diego County, I believe, to this day, and maybe in the whole country, is that Dr. Seuss wrote most all of his books, I think with the exception of one or two, in La Jolla. He moved to La Jolla, I believe, in the 46 or 48, and Bit was in the same house that whole time, and Audrey Geisel is still there, and he wrote and illustrated all those books. So there's going to be, and of course, he and she, he really loved the Whaling Bar at the La Valencia, and there's a booth number 3, which was his favorite booth. So there will be a very classy plaque being unveiled for him on that date, to honor Ted Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss. And you can come down anytime thereafter, 5 o'clock on, or any day or evening after that. And you'll certainly know where booth number 3 is for moving forward from here. So anyway.
And that's just down the street from where UBS's offices are on Prospect and La Jolla.
Same side of the street.
I think they're separated by maybe an ice cream store or two, and that's it.
And a coffee house and whatnot.
So anyway,
some retail.
It's going to be exciting, and I don't think the Padres will be in first place by then, but it'll be fun talking to Dick Enberg anyway.
Well, that's the All-Star break, and we'll see if anybody makes the All-Star team. Maybe the trainer will make the All-Star team. I don't know.
No, the trainer won't make the All-Star team because they have 13 guys on the disabled list.
Yeah, well, he's busy.
But anyway, Joe, we have to get to our guest. Tom McLaughlin, are you there?
I'm here. How you
all
doing?
Right. Doing great. How are you?
Well,
so, Tom, do you like green eggs and ham?
And I have stayed at the La Valencia, and I did not know it was booth 3.
Okay. Yes, well, now everyone will.
Now everybody knows that it's booth 3. But we have a very special guest from UBS, Mr. Thomas McLaughlin. And we love talking to Tom because he is actually UBS's head of municipal research. And, of course, out here in California, that's a big deal because, well, California was always seemingly in the news. But Tom, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today at UBS.
Well, I've been with UBS for about 2.5 years. And prior to joining UBS, I spent about 27 years in the public finance industry. Different sides of the table, as a rating agency analyst at Moody's Investor Service. also as an investment banker working on municipal bond deals for state and local governments. Spent some time with municipal bond insurers and worked on Capitol Hill for a few years as well.
What'd you do on Capitol Hill, out of curiosity?
You know, it's interesting. I was actually on the staff of something called the Office of Technology Assessment, which tended to provide nonpartisan advice to members of Congress, both in the Senate and in the House, on technology issues and financial issues. That office actually is no longer, it doesn't even exist anymore, and that is probably a reflection of the highly partisan nature of politics in D.C. today as compared to what it was 25 years ago.
Oh, that's unfortunate. So 25 years ago, so how did that office get formed and who was behind it? That's kind of an interesting little sideline there.
Well, it was interesting. It was formed back in the late 60s because members of Congress at the time were looking for nonpartisan advice on issues that were beyond the capability of their individual staffs. And as a consequence, we're in a position where they were looking for individual assessments of, you know, technology, whether it be the auto industry, whether it was a case of the banking industry. And as a consequence, they actually looked for individuals to step up and give them advice that was going to be untainted, whether it was Republican or Democrat. And unfortunately, that office came under attack. You know, to some degree, people were concerned about the fact that Congress was actually, the staffs were becoming too large. And as a consequence, they wanted to scale back. So this office was sacrificed among a number of other offices.
So I'm just wondering, it was initiated by the president at the time or someone in Congress? I'm just kind of curious how the whole thing came about.
Well, it was interesting. It was Speaker Gingrich. When he came in as Speaker, he went through with a scythe and basically took a lot of the individual offices out. And whether or not it was Speaker Gingrich that was driving more of a partisan approach to politics, or whether or not it was endemic, and it's probably endemic, both sides had figured, you know what, rather than get the nonpartisan, we want our own perspective to be brought into the fore for open public debate.
So Gingrich, but how did it start? Did it start under President Reagan or someone else in the Congress? Or?
Oh, no, actually the OTA, as they call it, Office of Technology Assessment, was around for about 20 years or so. This actually predated President Reagan.
Wow, interesting. Okay.
So, Tom, question. I recently shipped my girls off to Europe for a couple or 3 weeks. So they're traipsing around places like Monte Carlo. But there's been some interesting news coming out of Greece recently. Care to comment on Greece and the Eurozone?
Well, you know, probably better Monte Carlo than Greece.
Yeah, absolutely. I told them don't go to Greece.
Unless you're going down to the islands.
That's right.
You know, the global financial markets have been focused on Greece for at least 3 months. I mean, obviously, it's been in the news for longer than that, but the markets have been highly focused on Greece. The prospect of what's called a disorderly exit drove a lot of investors back into the United States and particularly back into the U.S. Treasury market. The Financial Times had coined a phrase back in 2007 called the flight to familiarity as an alternative to the flight to safety. And the flight to familiarity is, please let me get out of those instruments which I no longer understand and go back to something that I think I understand a little bit better. And we've seen a lot of that right now. We just had the elections in Greece. The conservative New Democracy Party came out ahead. It was awarded an extra 50 seats in the parliament because they won a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality of the votes. And as a consequence, they were in a position to form a coalition government with what they call PASOK, which is the socialists. Now, this is interesting. These are odd bedfellows. You had the conservatives and the socialists forming a coalition government in Greece. But it was preferable, at least from the perspective of the financial markets, through Syriza, which is a far-left party and which has very vocally rejected any sense of austerity coming out of Northern Europe. So what we saw in the elections were Greece coming together and saying, you know, we don't like the situation we're in very much, but we had a plurality of votes going to parties that were able to form a coalition government and at least ease some of the immediate pressure in the financial markets. Because I think the markets were on edge a couple of weekends ago when the election took place, and as a consequence, had New Democracy not come to the fore with a plurality, I think we would have been in a much worse position.
Oh, boy. We've got to take a break right there, though, Tom. Stay tight. Hang tight there. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs after these announcements.
Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
All right. We are back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. That is in honor of Dr. Seuss and the plaque that's going to be unveiled at the La Valencia Hotel. And we're back with Richard Musio, who has to thank some sponsors.
Of course, our major sponsor, UBS, and they're on this show. Also, Richard Gaines and Family Legacy Legal, Carl Sheeler and Business Valuations Limited, San Diego's finest CPA firm, Polito Epic CPAs, that's Paul Polito and Don Epic, Regents Bank in La Jolla, just across the street from La Valencia and UBS, and our newest sponsors, of course, La Valencia Hotel and Jason Kruger and Signature Analytics. Welcome aboard.
So we were
talking about the Eurozone, Joe. I guess our question is, Tom, how long do you expect Greece to play nicely, or do you think there might be some chance of things changing significantly later in the year?
Yeah, so do you think they might leave the Euro altogether?
My colleague in Europe, Thomas Vacher, actually recently wrote a report where he suggested that there was a 20 to 25% likelihood of Greece departing the euro within 12 months. So the best way to think about it, perhaps, is that the recent election in Greece subdued the crisis or subdued the level of concern in the financial markets, but in no way did it eliminate the concerns that most people have regarding the inability of Greece to support the amount of debt that on a household and a banking basis they've absorbed over the course of the last decade.
Is there light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, it seems like there's trillions of dollars being lent out at low interest to banks all over the world. I don't know if that's due to them getting involved in derivatives and then the investments turning sour, but you keep hearing that there's lack of transparency and we're not sure how much of this is out there. Is there do you see a bright spot in the future, Tom? Do you have any optimism?
I'm not terribly optimistic, I have to say, about the situation in Europe. You have three crises working at the same time. You've got a trade imbalance between the North and the South. You've got a banking crisis, and you've got a sovereign crisis. And that's a trifecta that is obviously a big challenge for any individual government, much less having three or four or five different governments struggling at the same time. You recall that Spain is looking to basically have a bit of assistance from the European Central Bank, the IMF, the European Union. This is a challenge that could easily spread into Italy as well. So at this point, no one is calling for the breakup of the euro, but keep in mind that the value of the euro as a currency has dropped fairly dramatically over the course, for currency trades anyway, has dropped fairly dramatically over the course of the last 6 months. So the market is expressing a more negative view of the situation in Europe simply by the value it's according to the currency in use.
And then how does that translate to the American economy when Europe is in trouble like that? Obviously, we export a lot of goods to them. I can't remember the figure, but I think it's like 16% of our GDP or some large number. So it's going to have some reverberations here, don't you think?
It will. The U.S. Is among those countries in the world that actually still have an expanding economy, albeit one that we all know is not expanding a lot. But it is growing very slowly. The world, to some degree, seems to be waiting for the American consumer to go ahead and increase consumption. The problem is that the American consumer is doing something that's coming very naturally, which is that we're all trying to delever. We're trying to basically reduce our indebtedness. And there's something called the paradox of thrift, where if everybody turns around and does the same thing by delevering or by reducing the amount of household debt, then, of course, you don't have an expanding economy. You have one that's contracting. And that's something the Federal Reserve is trying to react to. We're in a position right now where the ability of the Federal Reserve to continue to liquefy the markets, to continue to basically add impetus to more economic motion has been played out. They've done absolutely everything they can, and now we're looking at the rest of the year where we're looking at what we call the fiscal cliff at the end of this year,
mm-hmm.
where automatic tax increases take effect, where automatic budget cuts take effect, unless Congress acts. And if they don't act, we actually have more austerity coming into the United States? So the answer is yes. The answer is that as Europe slows down, it will have an impact on the American economy. The American economy is going to be challenged to continue to grow when you've got demand dissipating in Europe. So we should pay very close attention to what's going on in Europe because it will have an immediate impact on us.
You know, hang on. I need to send a text to my girls, tell them to try to pick up a cheap vacation home somewhere along the coast there before they
head
home.
Well, I got to say, you know, it's interesting. My daughter is going to Spain for a semester next year.
Okay.
And her mother and I are looking at this itinerary and saying, okay, you're going to spend a semester in Spain. I think this is probably a great life experience and one that I'm reasonably terrified about for my daughter as well, because I think it's going to be an economy and a society that's going to be in a state of flux while she's there.
Yeah, no question. No question. So getting back to your comment about the Bush tax cut sunsets, don't you think they'll just punt for about a year? Just, you know, everybody agree to just push the decision down the road for 1 year because of the uncertainty that the election brings to the whole debate anyway?
Yeah, I think they will punt, if you will. It may not be for a full year. It may be for 6 months. One of the things that is on the agenda, no matter who's elected, whether it's Governor Romney or President Obama, is this notion of tax reform. And both parties seem to be taking the issue of fundamental tax reform more seriously than they have in quite a while. The listeners will recall the last major tax reform act we had was 1986. And we've obviously done a lot to the tax code since, but in terms of an overarching comprehensive approach to taxation, it's been a long time. And we're seeing now a little more discussion in the halls of Congress about whether or not this is the appropriate time to take a look at the tax code on more of a holistic basis. So it is more likely than not that Congress will punt, if you will, or at least go ahead and roll, perhaps slow the budget cuts that are supposed to kick in on the 1st of January, and to go ahead and not have those tax increases that would otherwise take effect on the 1st of January by punting it into 2013.
I am nevertheless telling all of the very, very high net worth families that I work with that with regard to our ability to gift $5.12 million this year per spouse, that's probably the best it's ever going to be in history. Certainly it's the best it's ever been in history, and if anybody's in a position to do that, they should take advantage of that in 2012, because there's no way we're going to have better rules going forward. I mean, if we're lucky, it'll stay the same, but if we're not lucky, it won't. It'll get worse.
Yeah, no, I think that's good advice, just because we don't know exactly what the conversations in Congress are going to come to. I don't think Speaker Boehner knows. I don't think Minority Leader Pelosi knows. And to some degree, they're all waiting to see the outcome of the elections in November. So, you know, it's kind of a bird in the hand. You know exactly what the rules are right now, which you can take advantage of through the end of the year. After that, into next year, everything's going to be up for grabs. It's going to be a jump ball.
Well, with that thought, we have to take a break. We're talking with Tom McLaughlin, UBS analyst. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs after these announcements.
Talk Radio 760 KFN.
Welcome back to the second half of It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Joe Vecchio and Richard Nuccio, and our guest, UBS analyst Tom McLaughlin, and in-studio Michael Quaranta, vice president from UBS as well. Welcome back.
Michael, quick question to you. Were your kids fans of Dr. Seuss when they were growing up?
Absolutely. I've moved all the collection of Dr. Seuss books many times from one bookcase to another in the house.
Okay.
So I've got the titles memorized.
The Cat in the Hat.
Well, we're going to make some history next on July 8th, and everyone's welcome to come down, and I'm glad that UBS is a part of it.
Me too. So speaking of, well, hopefully California's not going to make any history, but Tom, question, recently Moody's, which is a rating service, downgraded California's tax allocation bonds. Can you briefly explain to our listeners what a tax allocation bond is and how significant this is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Tax allocation bonds are municipal securities that are secured by taxes on real estate. Now, the taxes generated to secure those bonds are generated by the assessed valuation within the particular district over and above a frozen base. So, well, it's better to do it by example. If you have a specific area of the city that's designated as a redevelopment zone, you can freeze the aggregate assessed valuations or the property values within that district at a certain level. And over time, as property values increase, and of course that's been a challenge over the last 3 or 4 years, but over time as property values increase, it creates an additional incremental valuation. And as that incremental valuation gets larger and larger over time, redevelopment agencies prior to their dissolution had issued bonds secured by taxes generated by that incremental amount of assessed valuation over time that was generated within that district. And Moody's, one of the major rating agencies, revised the ratings of California redevelopment agencies following their dissolution to a maximum level of Ba1. Ba1, for those who are not familiar, is the highest non-investment grade rating. In other words, these effectively were assigned as junk bonds. Now, I want to hasten to add to something, because this is very important. A lot of bonds are being held in the portfolios of California investors, and when they hear junk bonds, they probably get very, very nervous. First of all, Moody's took this action, and not the other two major rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Fitch. And secondly, despite the downgrade, Moody's acknowledged that the performance requirements set forth in the bond documents remain in place, and most redevelopment agencies continue to exhibit strong credit fundamentals. So it begs the question, why'd they do it? Well, there's concern that with the dissolution of redevelopment agencies in California, there are administrative failures that could take place in terms of allocating the taxes. If you think about it this way, for 30 years we've had redevelopment agencies issuing bonds, and the state legislature dissolved all of these redevelopment agencies, and there were almost 400 in California. And when they did so, they had to create a mechanism by which all these bonds could be repaid. And the law was very clear. Bondholders had to come first. The bonds had to be repaid. But you can imagine the administrative difficulty of dissolving almost 400 local governments at once and then finding a way to make sure and ensure that these bonds get paid. So Moody's took a preemptive action, and one, quite frankly, that I think they overreacted on and said, okay, you know, we don't know which of these is going to have the administrative difficulties that we're so concerned about, so we're going to place a maximum rating of Ba1. I think over time, Moody's will probably go ahead and begin to upgrade these back into investment-grade territory, and they're going to do it one at a time, as they see these administrative difficulties being overcome.
I read recently in Bloomberg News, though, that, for example, a couple of cities in California have missed some payments on their debt. I think it was Monrovia and Pico Rivera.
There was a report in Bloomberg Financial Newswire last week that those two places had missed it. Given the fact that there were, again, over 400, and neither of those, in those particular instances, had a lot of bonds outstanding, it's still not an overwhelming wave of defaults. And that's an important consideration for people. If you're holding a tax allocation bond, certainly you should discuss with your financial advisor the individual situation, but not all of the redevelopment agencies are acting in concert. They're not all defaulting by any stretch of the imagination.
And then there's a funny thing going on, too, here between the city of San Jose and Santa Clara County, too, with regard to these kinds of bonds.
The relationship between San Jose and Santa Clara County has never been great. They've been bickering on one matter or another for perhaps a generation. In this particular case, they are, and this is actually the concern that Moody's had, San Jose is the successor agency. The city of San Jose is the successor agency for the redevelopment agency. And they're relying on the county assessor and the county treasurer to distribute those taxes I talked about before, those incremental taxes, back to the paying agents for the bonds. And Santa Clara County has maintained that they were owed money by the San Jose Redevelopment Agency prior to the redevelopment agency's dissolution. And as a consequence of that dispute, Santa Clara County is saying that they need to haircut or remove off the top some of the money that they're owed. The city of San Jose, as successor to the redevelopment agency, is protesting that move, and they've both asked the state controller to step in. So over the course of this over the course of this next 2 months, I think State Controller John Chang is going to basically be in a position to have to weigh in and play referee in a lot of these circumstances. And I think he will. I think the state, which has been very slow to react, frankly, and there's not a whole lot of leadership that has been exhibited out of Sacramento to assist local governments in allocating these taxes, in overcoming the administrative obstacles. The fact that Santa Clara and San Jose have basically been in active dispute has given some impetus for the state to step in, and that's not a bad thing. You know, I think the French political philosopher Jean Monnet once said, people only accept change in necessity, and necessity only in crisis.
Well, as this all gets sorted out, Tom, I mean, it doesn't mean redevelopment comes to a halt in California indefinitely, and at some point in time there will be bonds to invest in for projects. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. It will take a different form. It's going to basically city governments going in and attempting to do it themselves rather than handing the keys to redevelopment over to redevelopment agencies.
Okay.
Because I think the dissolution of these redevelopment agencies is something that is now a done deal. Mm-hmm. They're not going to come back. But you'll find individual redevelopment agency personnel being distributed into city government, and those individuals are quite capable, and they're going to go ahead and work within the structure of city government to promote redevelopment. And San Diego is a very good example of that.
So it's just a matter of caveat emptor and shop around, right?
You have to shop around. Every minute. This is true for everything. It's particularly true in redevelopment. Every municipal bond is unique at this point. And you really have to look at the underlying credit fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't one of the points Moody's was sort of making is that disclosure sometimes is lacking with regard to these investments?
Well, this is true, but it's not unique to redevelopment agencies. State governments are sovereign in our federal system. And as a consequence, other than the anti-fraud prohibition, the Securities and Exchange Commission is not empowered to go ahead and regulate the disclosure for municipal bonds, because again, state governments are sovereign. So the Congress hasn't seen fit yet to go ahead and authorize the SEC to regulate that. Again, for that, except with that one very important exception, there's nothing that allows a state or a local government to obviously disclose information that's materially incorrect. But with that exception, states and local governments have a fair amount of discretion as to how quickly they get information out to investors after the fact, once bonds are issued. And the performance varies, and it varies by individual state or local government. You see situations where some local governments, and there's only a handful, are very quick. They're very quick to respond to investor inquiries. They're putting out quarterly information, et cetera. By and large, a lot of small local governments within all the states, not just California, are having difficulty getting out information as quickly as a corporation might. And to some degree, it's because they're not under the same regulatory scrutiny from Washington.
Interesting. Well, that's interesting. We've got to take a short break, though. Tom, sit tight. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money Not Theirs after these announcements. Welcome back to the last segment of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. And just another reminder to please come and join us for our live remote broadcast from the landmark La Valencia Hotel next Sunday. We'll be there at 7 o'clock. Excuse me. Actually, we'll be there earlier. And we'll have a lot of our sponsors there, Michael Caranta and many from UBS and many other sponsors. And come out and see the plaque that will be dedicated to Dr. Seuss from that day forward. So,
and come on out and meet all of the sponsors. I think everybody's going to be represented. Yes, there's real people behind all these names that I shout out every week. And so it's going to be a fun event.
And we thank them for supporting our cause. Right, Richard?
Oh, absolutely. And hopefully it'll be a nice sunny day. It won't be foggy.
Like the U.S. Open, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. I was watching that a couple of weeks. But anyway. So, Tom, back to, well, sort of California, but I guess this is more of a global question. The pensions and public pensions. I know we just had a Proposition B, a vote here in San Diego about the pension issue, but it's sort of a statewide. It's actually sort of a nationwide issue. The effect on ratings and the ability of states to perform, given that most of them have, well, pension liabilities that greatly exceed the amount of money that are presently put away to satisfy those pensions. Please comment.
You know, as private sector workers have struggled to find new employment, often with fewer benefits in the aftermath of the recession, the popular support for traditional, if I can call it that, public employee benefits has dissipated quite a bit. So we're seeing a sea change, in terms of the willingness of society to accept the notion that the public sector benefits are so much more generous than those generally available in the private sector. There's been a lot of media attention devoted to Governor Scott Walker's victory in Wisconsin's recall election. But I think the two local elections in California are equally significant from a public policy perspective. San Diego, as you pointed out, and San Jose, you know, the second and third most populous cities in California, passed two local referenda to constrain and restrain the growth in pension liabilities for local governments. And, you know, this is a trend that is beginning to get traction throughout the country. But whenever two of the largest cities in California take such action, it does have national import. And we're seeing an expectation that pension reform is going to be something that is going to be prevalent in all the states. State of California, the state of New York, the state of Illinois, those three states will be, I think, among the last to really take it up. But we've seen the beginning, I think, of a 3 to 5 year process by which we'll see more reforms.
But what's happened to pensions overall historically, Tom? I mean, I think around 1980, about 84% of workers in the private sector had a defined benefit plan. I believe that number is down to 20%. What happened to those pensions? Did the private sector say, we don't want to give them out anymore, or we've shifted your retirement money, or it's gone? I mean,
well, most of the private sector, not all, but most of the private sector has moved to a defined contribution pension system. And for your listeners, the difference between the defined benefit, that's what you would call a traditional pension program, where after so many years of service, you're given a monthly benefit check upon retirement based on the years of service and your age. A defined contribution program is akin to a 401k program, and that's where America's corporations have, and the private sector generally, has moved towards. But it's something that the public sector is not going to completely escape. It's interesting because I took a look at the numbers before hopping onto the program today, and 15 separate states passed legislation to reform some aspect of state-run retirement systems in 2009 alone. Another dozen did it in 2008. So you're seeing more states move towards either a full-blown 401k-style system or, more likely, a hybrid system. And the hybrid system would have an element of defined benefit, more akin to a traditional program, and then also something along the lines of a 401k with a match from the public sector towards the individual's retirement.
Because you just have to time it right when you're ready to retire. That the market's doing better than it did in the past. If it's in a downtrend and you're retiring.
Well, you know, it's interesting to say that because that's one of the real challenges. You know, the calculation of a government's pension liability relies on a lot of assumptions, and by definition, therefore, it's going to be inexact. CalPERS, as of June 2010. This is the California Public Employees Retirement System. As of June of 2010, depending on whether you talk about the school employees or the state government employees, was funded to a ratio of about 63 to about 66%. But you had, from June 2010 to June 2011, you had a strong market. And as a consequence, the expectation is that the funding ratio jumped above 70%. But it's all assumptions-based. Mm-hmm. And it also assumes a very large return on investments. So CalPERS is assuming they're going to get 7.5% over the next 25 years.
Every year, right?
Which... Yeah, exactly. And it's a very optimistic assumption, and one that, quite frankly, really can't be supported except through an historical looking glass. So for the last 25 years, the average return on pension investments was 8.5%. But the problem is that the last 25...